White Rocket Entertainment.
Excuse me, Mr. Stark. Christine Everhart, Vanity Fair Magazine. Can I ask you a couple of questions?
She's cute. She's all right. Hi.
Hi.
Yeah.
It's okay?
Okay, go.
You've been called the Da Vinci of our time. What do you say to that?
Absolutely ridiculous. I don't paint.
And what do you say to your other nickname, the Merchant of Death?
That's not bad. Let me guess. Berkeley?
Brown, actually.
Well, Ms. Brown, it's an imperfect world, but it's the only one we've got. I guarantee you, the day weapons are no longer needed to keep the peace, I'll start making bricks and beams for baby hospitals.
You rehearse that much?
Every night in front of the mirror before bedtime.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Avengers Assemble 005, Iron Man.
It's the Avengers Assemble podcast from the Jarvis Heads of AvengersAssemble.net. Now, here's your host, Van Allen Plexico.
Hello, and welcome to the Avengers Assemble podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment and the Jarvis Heads of AvengersAssemble.net in association with the Earth Station One Network. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and I'm joined this episode by my good friend Mark Buskett. Mark has been one of our chief movie reviewers for the White Rocket podcast for the last 4 years. He is also the editor, publisher, and writer for Space Buggy Press, and probably best known as the author of the Gunfighter Gothic series. And also, he has reviewed in print basically every Marvel movie. And so, Mark, welcome aboard the new show.
Thanks, Van. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, our plan is to kind of go through periodically, along with all the various other topics that this show will explore. We're going to periodically come on, and the two of us are going to talk about the Marvel movies. And I think that the listeners are really going to enjoy that as one of the several different threads we'll be weaving through the Avengers Assemble podcast. And so you are absolutely my number one go-to guy for talking about the Marvel movies, of course. And so I'm thrilled to have you back on again.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So, let us get into it. This is our first foray into the Marvel movies, and we're going to cover the first Iron Man movie today. And that goes back to 2008. In fact, I had a couple of notes about it. Let me see. And that was the big gamble, right? I mean, the first Iron Man movie was Marvel making the assumption, and I think it's been proven absolutely true, and DC helps this assumption be more true every day. It was Marvel making the assumption that they could make better movies using their characters than anybody else could. And there was a lot of doubt, I think, about that at first, because they were not in the movie making business ever before. They were, in fact, in the giving our characters away almost free business. And so what did you think when Marvel first said we're going to, like, borrow $1 billion and make our own movies? Did you think brilliant idea, or, oh, my gosh, they're going to ruin it forever?
I thought I'd be able to buy the stock for 25 cents a share again. I mean, it was I remember being – and I was thinking about this last night when I was watching – when I was rewatching Iron Man, trying to remember what it was like in the heady days of 2006 and 2007, as this, you know, the news came out that they were raising this financing, that they were going to make their own movies. And I was a bit nervous, but I was also, I also gave them a lot of credit, right? I mean, they had the movie rights for the Marvel movies were such a mess for such a long time that I thought it was kind of inspired that they kind of, you know, they had this mass of characters all, you know, either luckily or not kind of related to the Avengers that they could make their own cinematic universe with. And so I thought it was really, really inspired, but I was also a little bit nervous at what they were attempting, especially, you know, since they went and hired a non-action star like Robert Downey Jr. to be the linchpin character of an action franchise. So I was pretty nervous about it until we started seeing the footage. And I mean, I remember when we saw that that Comic-Con trailer, that first Comic-Con trailer that kind of leaked out onto YouTube and everything. We were all watching clips from people's cell phones. Yeah. That was kind of when it was like, oh, they might know what they're doing here.
Yeah, I had downloaded that actual leaked clip, and I guess it was 2007, and we have about 300 people that come to Marvel DC Jeopardy every year, our tournament at Dragon Con, and back then I was using a PowerPoint thing to do the tournament, and so I put up on the screen before the tournament started, I put that video up there, and we showed the trailer. And that place exploded. Some of them, a lot of them hadn't seen it because it was like it had just come out right before Labor Day weekend. And there was a lot of excitement. And I'm sitting there thinking, people are this excited about Iron Man. I never thought I'd see the day, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I was like giddy, you know? I mean, it was kind of, because at that point, we had plenty of good superhero movies, right? Like, the first Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movie was a legitimate good movie, right? We had had some of the X-Men films had been out. We had had the Blade films been out. And, of course, you always had the kind of up-and-down quality of the Batman franchise. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like it had been 20 years since we had seen a superhero movie. But it was obvious from the first trailer. I mean, I'm smiling even like remembering watching all those clips that it was clear that this was like something different and that this – that this could really be special. You know, it was that first Comic-Con trailer where I started to get the idea that we might really be in for something here. Like, this isn't going to be just another superhero movie. Like, they really might be on to a new way of doing things that, and like you said, crazy to believe that the people that had been doing the comics would know how to do the movies the best, had the best understanding of the character rather than somebody coming in from the outside. But yeah, they just right from that first trailer, they nailed the right tone, nailed the right mix of like action and humor and acting. And yeah, it was, all systems go right from then.
Yeah. And as an Iron Man fan, of course, I'm sure our listeners know he's my favorite character. It was kind of a bittersweet thing for me. Before we get into the movie itself, just a couple more things. Like, for example, when I was a kid and loved Iron Man so much, you could not find an Iron Man toy to play with. The only thing that existed was the Mego action figure. It had the nose.
Yeah.
So, I was searching in futility for an Iron Man toy. I had to make my own. I had to take like my Captain Kirk Mego figure and make him a helmet and stuff, gloves. So I was thrilled to see the huge success of Iron Man and see the toys and everything come out. But I'm like, I'm so old at that point. I felt like we were going to Target and buying all the Iron Man toys. But in fact, I've got on the shelf behind me, when we had our video production going for a while there on the White Rocket Show, people could see the shelf behind me. And I've got my Iron Man bobbleheads and stuffed animals and everything. But I think for purposes of this episode only, I've got my Iron Man that wears an Auburn football helmet. And let me see if he, let's see if he will do this.
Repulsor blast. I am Iron Man.
There you go.
Outstanding. Yeah, I'm a little bit younger than you. So when I was, of that age where I was buying toys, there was the Secret Wars line was out. So I had an Iron Man Secret Wars action figure that I had because, Iron Man flies. And so I didn't put him on a shelf. I had hung him from like the ceiling of my bedroom. So it was like, I don't know, he was hovering in the corner, which seemed like a good idea at the time. And then I never bothered to move it. But yeah, it was, I don't think people can really appreciate now maybe where we're getting, Ant-Man movies and Doctor Strange movies and,
yeah.
We've got Iron Fist getting a Netflix series and Luke Cage getting who was Jessica Jones? I mean, she didn't even exist when we were kids and she's got her own show. Just kind of how unlikely it was that they were starting with Iron Man. And I don't know all of the kind of behind the scenes permutations of what led to them starting with Iron Man. But it ended up being, I mean, the absolute perfect choice. I mean, the perfect actor, the perfect director, the perfect vehicle. You know, like we said, to not only launch a franchise, but really set the blueprint for the whole Marvel Cinematic Universe.
And before we really analyze the movie in any depth, the other thing I wanted to kind of ask you about and get your views on is, obviously, you've reviewed all these various movies and thought about them a lot. I mean, how many are there now?
Well, just the cinematic universe, there's, I think Civil War was number 13 in the series. And then beyond Civil War, we've got Doctor Strange, Guardians 2, Spider-Man, Thor 3, Black Panther, Avengers 3, Ant-Man, Captain Marvel, and Avengers 4. Wow. So they've got movies out through, you know, May 2019.
It's crazy.
Yeah, 22. They have 22 movies, either 13 completed and another what, 9 on the schedule. Yeah. So yeah, it's unbelievable. And like, you do kind of wonder, you know, is this going to be like the last kind of cycle? I mean, of kind of the classic Avengers, right? Are we going to get, you know, they just in the last week they announced that Avengers Infinity War was going to go back to being one movie instead of two movies. And so now I wonder if kind of Avengers 4, is that going to be the movie where we see an Avengers film, you know, without the big three in it, right? Is this going to be a transition movie? You know, are we going to get an Avengers movie with Captain Marvel and Black Panther and Spider-Man and Doctor Strange and Ant-Man, right? Or are they going to continue with, are they going to bring all these guys back under contract? They said they're committed to a Black Widow movie, so one would assume she's, Scarlett Johansson will be back for Avengers 4. But, you know, we are in kind of this place now in between, you know, right at the start of Phase 3, where we can start to kind of wonder if we're in a real kind of turning point here. And so I think it's the perfect time to kind of look back where we've come from in this cinematic universe.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, my understanding, now you may just be reading it differently from me and we'll see, but my understanding as far as the two remaining Avengers movies is that they were just changing the name of number 3 to make it more of a separate story building up to the Thanos story, rather than making it seem like the Thanos story is just in two parts, like the Mockingjay.
Oh, okay.
Ollie, you know, in other words, they didn't want to do it like Harry Potter or Mockingjay, where the last two installments are just like two halves of a movie.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I like your idea kind of better in a way. Go ahead and deal with the thing in 3, and then have 4 as like a jumping off point for a whole new thing. That's and to me, that's even more intriguing. But it makes sense also, though, in the other way, that they could be saving all the big stars for the big finale. So I could kind of see it either way, pretty 50-50.
Right. Yeah. I think at this point, I'm just happy. I mean, the movie's still 2 years away, right? Or the first Infinity War movie is still 2 years away. So they've got time to kind of play with it. But yeah, it is going to be interesting to see, you know, this Phase 3 has, you know, a rollout of a whole bunch of new characters. So are we going to see, you know, is the plan for these new films to be standalone franchises, or is the point to roll them into, let them take over the Avengers franchise? You know, and that's that. If they do that, that's obviously a good way to kind of keep costs down. We know for the most part, Marvel doesn't like to give out big bucks in salary to any of these actors. And so you wonder if it's a way to kind of, keep the cost, at least the upfront cost, down and transition the franchise going forward. Or if the plan is to, you know, bring Robert Downey and Chris Evans and Chris Hemsworth back, maybe just for Avengers movies. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how they roll it going forward. I mean, they're all basically going to be, their contracts are going to be up with the next two Avengers films, however they split it. So it'll be really interesting to see how they, you know, there's always rumors about Iron Man 4. I don't see any reason why we can't get more Captain America movies. I mean, those have been fantastic so far. It doesn't feel like that's a franchise that's run out of steam in any way. So you kind of wonder, like, exactly, you know, where they're going. I mean, if the next Iron Man movie doesn't come out till, say, 2020, you know, you wonder if that's even something that they want to do, or is it just a matter of Robert Downey saying, "Yeah, I'm on board," and then they find room in the schedule for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be very interesting. I mean, just the sheer quantity of properties and projects they're trying to do now. I mean, somebody was saying the other day that Marvel's got more projects headed to Netflix than Netflix has opening to plug them in, you know. And so, which brings me to one other question I was going to raise to you. It just occurred to me, I've had a couple of conversations lately on this show and White Rock and other shows talking about this, and it never even quite dawned on me, but the Doctor Strange movie that comes out this fall. Now, I've been speculating, others have been speculating, that Doctor Strange might be building up toward filling the Warlock spot, since they haven't introduced Warlock yet and they need some kind of a weird cosmically powered guy that can kind of field general. But think about this. I hadn't thought about it from the Doctor Strange side of that equation. I keep thinking about it from the Warlock side. Correct me if I'm wrong here. Doctor Strange is going to be the first Marvel Cinematic Universe movie that is not an Avengers-related movie, at least on the surface.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's you know, and again, that goes certainly not a classic Avenger, you know, brought in during the Bendis years. So I guess he's been an Avenger for however long that's been going on now, at least related to it. But yeah, it's not the first. I mean, they've seemed to say, look, the films are going to be the Avengers-related properties, and then Netflix is going to be, you know, kind of everything else. And so, I've right from the start, I've been curious about why Doctor Strange is a movie and not a Netflix series. I mean, I think his more natural home, maybe it's just because we're old, but his more natural home for me has always been with the street heroes, right? Has always been with the Defenders, and I think he fits much better with, you know, the Daredevil, Luke Cage, Iron Fist, Jessica Jones, Punisher group of heroes on Netflix than he does in the Avengers. So I wonder if it was a matter – I wonder if they had discussions on that. And I wonder if it simply came down to, look, this, if we do this right, this is going to be incredibly expensive. So maybe we need to make it a movie to kind of justify having, you know, $150, $200 million budget, whatever it's going to have, as opposed to doing it on Netflix, where as excellent as those shows have been, right, there's not a lot of special effects going on, right? I'm assuming that the budget costs on those are in line with, you know, with TV shows, rather than, I don't think they're getting an extraordinary budget to do those shows comparatively. So maybe they figured if they're going to do it, they have to roll the dice and do it as a movie. Or maybe, as you said, I hadn't thought of the being the Warlock stand-in, but maybe they have him geared up for a bigger role going forward, that they need a character to serve that function, and so they want to get him into the universe. And at this point, like, I mean, they can make a movie about just about any character. I mean, you know, I mean, there's talk now on Twitter the last couple of weeks that Anna Kendrick wants to play Squirrel Girl in a movie. So, I mean, if they announced tomorrow that they were doing a Squirrel Girl movie, I don't think, one, anybody would be surprised, and two, anybody would think it would be anything other than a box office hit. I mean, you know, we live in a world where Ant-Man is getting a sequel, you know? I mean, that's just, I mean, it's, you know, it's such a golden age of filmed productions, right, of TV shows and of movies based on superheroes. Like, I'm almost ashamed to admit, like, I still haven't watched season 2 of Daredevil. And it's not because I don't want to watch it. It's because there's so many – we're so blessed with things to watch that, you know, it's an overabundance. And you can certainly pick and choose. And, you know, you don't feel like – you know, when Iron Man came out even it was like you had to go see every superhero movie, right? Because it was this idea that if you didn't go see this movie, then the next movie might not get made, right? Or if this movie only did, you know, $250 million at the box office instead of $400 million at the box office. Maybe the next movie has a $90 million budget instead of a $120 million budget or a $140 million budget. And we've reached the point where we don't have to do that anymore, where we can go see the movies that we want to see when we want to see them, right? And it's the same thing with the TV shows. You know, I haven't watched season two or what's the season four of Arrow yet, whatever their current seasons are. I figured, you know, I'll just wait till Netflix gets them and then binge watch the whole thing in 4 days instead of, you know, having it drag out over 5 or 6 months. So, I mean, it is – we are in a very lucky time. And I think that really, as much as there were films and hit films, big box office films before Iron Man, it's hard for me to see Iron Man as anything but some kind of turning point in kind of the, you know, the cultural zeitgeist about superhero movies. That was the one, maybe because he's lesser known, right, than Batman or Spider-Man or the X-Men, that was the one where people had to say, like, oh, like, this is a thing now, right? This isn't just like some genre that fills a niche. This is something everybody wants to see, whether they've read the comics or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't watched. I'm about 4 or 5 episodes into Daredevil season two, but I've just started in the last week because I had so many other things. Exactly like you said, I'll point out we live in a world where Squirrel Girl has gotten too big for the Great Lakes Avengers. She's gone solo. Sting leaving the police, you know, Squirrel Girl.
Yeah,
the Great Lakes Avengers. So, well,
yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about Iron Man. This is a movie that came out in 2008, but actually was in development all the way back to 1990. You know, I remember there was talk of like what's his name from Titanic? Oh, I'm blank out on everybody's name.
DiCaprio.
Yeah, there was. I mean, wasn't at one point or another he was rumored to either be playing Spider-Man or Iron Man or both? And maybe Tom Cruise, I want to say, was talked about for Iron Man a couple of times?
Yeah, Tom Cruise was definitely linked to Iron Man, and he apparently didn't like the script. Because it's not a – right, Tom Cruise makes Tom Cruise movies. Like, mm-hmm. I've talked about this, you know, with other people that – like. Tom Cruise still believes people want to go to see Tom Cruise in a Tom Cruise movie, right? As kind of tastes have changed. And so that's, I think, one of the reasons why he hasn't jumped into any of these superhero movies is, you know, the Marvel movies aren't Tom Cruise movies, right? Even the DC movies, you know, that's a whole nother conversation, but the DC movies aren't Tom Cruise movies. They don't kind of easily fit. And so he's going to have to change what he does to fit into these universes. And he's still, you know, pumping out movies that the same kind of movies that he's been doing for a long time now. And so apparently he didn't like the script, but yeah, it's been all the way back to 1990. You know, Universal bought the rights first. And then by 96, mid 90s, Fox got the rights. Nick Cage was interested at one point. Tom Cruise was interested at one point. And then I think it all kind of fell apart. And eventually Fox sold the rights to New Line. And then at some point Marvel got the rights back and you know, decided to start over, right? To go back to the drawing board, kind of throw out everything, all of the cinematic pre-production work that had been done on it and just kind of like start over from ground zero.
Yeah, it seems like the overview of it. Let me say a couple of things about the overview. I don't love everything about it looking back now. I mean, at the time I was just absolutely thrilled, mainly because it was an Iron Man movie, it looked great and it worked and it was funny and all that. I'm not sure Iron Man's supposed to be funny, but we'll get to that in a minute. But looking back now, I've thought for years now, how would I have structured an Iron Man movie story that introduced him to the public and done it better? And I think that the issues I have with it are as a lifelong Iron Man fan, Obadiah Stane just does not move the needle for me. I just do not care about that character. And so, you know, we've said all along, many people, how the weak link in a lot of the Marvel movies have been the villains who never quite measure up to the heroes. And by the way, I said on the show with George Gaston last episode that I thought that one of the reasons Civil War was so good, one of many reasons, is because the villains of it were basically more heroes, and Marvel's heroes are more interesting in the movies than their villains. So when you make the villains of the movie more heroes, you have more interesting characters as heroes and villains. But anyway, I'll let you chew on that for a second and you can address it. But anyway, in terms of Stane, he was not my first choice or 10th choice for the villain. But looking back, I have a lot to say about the Mandarin. We'll get to when we talk about the third one, but basically, when I look at that movie now, as an Iron Man fan, I'm kind of disappointed by its structure, its villain, and all that. But overall, I really think there was not much of a better way that you could have thrown all the stuff into a movie in 2 hours that you needed to introduce Iron Man and make people care about him and be excited about him and his supporting characters. I can't think of a better way in retrospect to have done his origin story. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, I have said a billion times at this point, like, I'm tired. In 2016, I'm tired of origin stories, right? And that's kind of the one real concern I have about the Doctor Strange movie. It's like, oh, do we really have to sit through this? Like, we get it. Like, we understand. Just start with a guy being a fully formed hero, and we get it. Unless you're going to do something like season one of Daredevil, where they took a whole season to really explore it. But to sit through a 2-hour origin story at this point, I'm not on board. And I think, you know, we'll talk about it when we do the first Avenger. I think that's one of the problems I had with the first Captain America movie, is it's really 2-hour-long movies jammed together, the first being the origin story and the second being the actual movie.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back at Iron Man, you know, they move through that kind of that opening sequence in about 30 minutes, I guess, before he's, you know, while he's captured and he builds the first Iron Man suit and then he gets back. And I do think that it was about as condensed without feeling rushed of an origin story as they could have done, unless they were going to make the whole movie the origin story, which I'm glad they didn't. I mean, I think you want to get up and running, they did it about as well as you can do it. And what works for me about it is that Downey Jr. makes it all very believable, right? He makes these transitions believable. I mean, Stark goes from being, you know, a kind of glib weapons manufacturer, loves to blow things up, get drunk, bed women at the start of the film. And then he has his, you know, his moment in the cave where he sees, where he's captured, and he makes that transition into being more, less interested in building weapons, right? Or at least less interested in building weapons that are sold to the enemy. And I think Stark makes that transition believable, because the thing I love about his performance, right, is whether it's the start of the film, the middle of the film, the end of the film, he does everything for himself, right? I mean, as much as Obadiah Stane, he's just there as a function, right? He's just there to kind of advance the plot in ways the plot needs to advance to get to the next set piece. He does have that great line where he says to Tony, like, you know, only you could decide, you know, to get out of the weapons business and then build like the greatest weapon anybody has ever seen, right? And so that idea of Stark always kind of being self-centered and flawed, I think it was really, really key to making the film seem different. It was really key to making the audience connect with the film. I mean, I was so glad, you know, and I mean, I never thought of Iron Man as a funny guy. And I had said at the time when it came out, you know, we're living in a world where, you know, Iron Man is more fun than Spider-Man, right? And like that shouldn't ever be. I mean, I can't imagine there's a character who's easier to make a movie about than Spider-Man. I mean, it just, and yet, film after film has been kind of disappointing. And the first two Tobey Maguire films, at least, I liked both of them. But I haven't watched the first one in forever because it's just an origin story. And the second one I watch, you know, here and there. But both of those films, there's so much angst and there's so much kind of like, oh, being a superhero is tough. And it's, you know, it's not like, I mean, I get that there are downsides to it. And there's that, you know, great scene in Iron Man where, you know, Stark addresses that kind of head on with Pepper, right? Like, oh, are you going to be, you know, worried and staying up late and, you know, upset that I might be out there, like, getting killed or whatever? And he just kind of blows by it, right? Because the joy of cinematic Stark, at least, is that he sees the, you know, all of the good parts about being a superhero, right? He's an incredibly hopeful character, like, and maybe he's self-centered, or he's definitely self-centered, but he really believes like one person can make a difference, right? Now he believes it's him, and over the course of the films, he's had to learn that he can, you know, rely on other people too. But he is like, he really does believe in the power of the individual to make a difference in the world. And he's self-centered, and he's still snarky and kind of a jerk. But you know, that's what really made it work, right? When you get to the end of the film, and he has that like, he's not going to read the prepare. He decides on the fly not to read the prepared statement, to just announce that he's Iron Man to the world. And you see the press corps, like, all jump up, right, except for the Vanity Fair reporter that he had slept with. But the whole press jumps up and is like, you know, like, oh, I can't believe you just admitted this. That kind of – that was, like, such a welcome release, I think, for me as a fan. Like, yes, like, we've got a superhero who doesn't hate being a superhero, right?
Yeah.
Like, there is some tragedy in his story, but – he's able to kind of see through that and get past that, you know. And, you know, we've had plenty of really good Batman movies, but that kind of – that overwhelming grimness of, like, you know, just how – just miserable a guy he is, right? That he can't get past, you know, what happened to him and, you know, becomes, you know, especially, like, say, in the comics and the Frank Miller version, slightly psychotic. That it's just very grim and dark and kind of, like – depressing. And it was so nice at the time to see a bright, vibrant superhero movie with a flawed character who nonetheless loved being a superhero, because as a fan we love them being superheroes. So it was nice to see a character who loved doing it too.
Yeah, I said from the beginning that Iron Man is basically Batman who has fun. And people would rather see you be good at something and have fun than be good at something and be miserable. I mean, I know that Batman is more popular and everything, although these days it's pretty close.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Tony Stark is basically Bruce Wayne, right down to the parents being murdered. Now we learn by the bad guys. And yet, although he was kind of a good guy, but you know, but anyway,
yep.
That they are so similar in so many ways, and yet Tony has so much fun with it. And that's much more pleasant and enjoyable to watch. Now you talk about Stane as the villain, and I agree. He kind of was just more like served a plot purpose than he was an actual character. Certainly in the comics, I didn't like that character. To me, he was just a re-upping of Midas from the Bill Mantlow period, which I liked. But the thing about Stane that I did think that they did interesting with him in the movie was make him basically part of the family. Like, he was like the crazy uncle. He was almost like the Dr. Doom of the Richards family in the movie, but in disguise. In other words, I like the idea that he had a connection to Tony's father, and that they actually went back a ways, and Stane was actually kind of like the chairman of the board or whatever, you know, and Tony was like the – I mean, it was almost putting Downey into the old sort of John Hughes movie situation again, where he's the kid that goes off to college and wants to party while the uncle's running the business, you know?
Yep.
And it's a classic story that goes back to like the Kings of England, where the prince is like, Hal is out partying while the regent runs the country and tries to plot to murder the prince, you know, so he can, you know, like Richard III almost or something. There's interesting echoes of that relationship throughout literature and history. So I liked that they made Stane into a threat who was an internal threat rather than an external threat. I did like that. But other than – and I thought Jeff Bridges played him very interestingly as kind of a in a way kind of an appealing character, but really had a dark side that could show through. You know, you really kind of liked him for the first half of the movie until you start seeing, because he was always very supportive. He's like, Tony, and he's hugging him and everything, and he was an appealing character for like the first half of the movie until they start giving you the first few clues that he's kind of up to something. What did you think about Stane in terms of how they laid him out as a character over the course of the movie?
Well, I totally agree. I mean, he was like the transitional head of Stark Industries, right? I mean, between Tony's dad's death and Tony taking over the company, like, Stane ran the company. And so he has an investment in the company itself, right? And there's a bit of jealousy, I'm sure. Like, he was running it for, I mean, I don't know how many years they were supposed to think it was between Howard Stark's death and Tony taking over the company. But at least, you know, he ran the company. So it was, when you run something, you feel very proprietary over it. And so I think he is slightly sympathetic in the sense that when Tony comes back and decides, like, hey, we're not doing weapons anymore, right? That Stane is the guy who, like, has to sit in the office and deal with the contracts and make sure everything gets made. While Tony sits in his lab and gets crazy inventive, Stane's the guy on the factory floor, like, making sure people stick to deadlines, making sure items get shipped, schmoozing the military or their government contracts. Like, he is the one who has to do all of the kind of infrastructure work that allows the company to keep going, that allows Tony to have a great house and great cars and a private lab right at his Malibu home. So he was I thought that was a good switch, right? I thought it gave him interest in the film, and it made the kind of back and forth between him and Tony it gave it a little bit more energy to it, I think, because Stane wasn't somebody – I mean, he was trying to take over the company, but he was also invested in kind of the long-term health of the company. And, I mean, just think, you know, if you had a co-host for the White Rocket podcast and then, you know, they came in, you know, and then you left, right, and they were doing the show, you know, without you. But keeping it going, and then you came back and said, all right, from now on, we're just discussing romantic poetry of the 17th century, right? They'd be like, well, what the heck? Like, you know, the show's grown while you've been gone. We've been doing all this work. We were invested in it. And now it's like something completely different. So I do think he is sympathetic in that point. I do wish – I mean, you knew he was the bad guy, right? I mean, you knew that was going to kind of come out all along. But it's not – again, it's not necessarily – can you figure these movies out? Is the process enjoyable? Is the journey an enjoyable one? And I think with Stane, they did a good job. I do kind of wish they had shown more of his kind of behind the scenes machinations. I mean, I think maybe that would have given that character a little bit more oomph. But again, that gets back to Stark being self-centered, right? That even the movie kind of mirrors the character in being self-centered. And so you don't, you know, you only get glimpses of how his actions affect Pepper and Rhodey and Stane. And then, you know, all of those eventually at some point come home to roost, and he has to deal with, you know, the consequences of, you know, of keeping them away. Only if not keeping them away, but just being focused like on himself. So I thought that was good. I do wish we had kind of maybe seen more of that. But, you know, it is a 2-hour movie. Now they could do a 2.5-hour movie and nobody'd blink, or they could film 30 minutes of scenes and throw out an extended edition and just, you know, rake in the cash. But, you know, at the time I thought, you know, I thought it was a wise decision to focus on Tony kind of to the exclusivity that they did. Especially the most amazing thing about this movie to me is how many scenes there are of just Tony sitting in the laboratory and working, right? Like, in your standard action movie, when people build things, right, that's the montage. That's like, we're going to play a rock song, something vaguely inspirational, and we're going to churn through this stuff in like 30 seconds to a minute and kind of get on with it. And, you know, there is some of that in Iron Man, but there's also a lot of just sitting at his workbench working, right? All the stuff with the CGI models and, you know, actually doing the wiring and doing the testing and having things fail, and, you know, that relationship he has with Jarvis and the dummy robot. that, you know, it just struck me last night rewatching it. Like, man, there, a lot of this movie is just him standing here working.
Yeah.
Which is not the, you know, the main formula for success for an action movie, but because of Downey's personality, I think they were able to kind of make all those scenes work. And because they were, you could see the armor being built, right? I think that was, I mean, you saw it being built, you know, twice. I thought that was an important part of the process and making us understand who Stark is. You know, I think in another movie, you know, like if I was, you know, if they had hired me to do, you know, to write the Iron Man movie that was going to launch this franchise, I might have done less. I almost certainly would have done less of the work studio stuff and more of, you know, developing Stane, developing a relationship between Rhodey and Pepper, and seeing how, you know, kind of the world circled around Tony instead of being so focused on him. But I mean, luckily they didn't hire me. They hired Jon Favreau. And I think it was every decision they made, I think at the time, was the decision that needed to be made.
It worked out that way. The other thing about Stane and Tony's relationship that I think is interesting is I may be wrong, but it seems to me that every other movie or story that has used that kind of a relationship, where the way that you just described it, you know, where he kind of comes in to take over the company and the guy's been around for a while doing it a certain way, every time they've ever done that, it's at the beginning of the younger person coming in, and they're naive and they're learning and all that. And one of the things I thought was really enjoyable about how they structured this movie is that Tony is already in charge when the movie starts. He's already a grown up. He's already, you know, out partying and spending his billions of dollars. And he and Pepper have a really interesting relationship. I'm going to talk about the supporting cast next. And it just was kind of refreshing to not have him be like 19, 20, 21 years old, you know, coming into the company for the first time, wide-eyed and naive. Instead, we got him already kind of cynical. He just didn't know all the truth yet. You know, the movie is more about him learning specifics and bad stuff rather than him growing up. I mean, he grows as a character certainly by his experiences, and when he, you know, when he embraces being Iron Man at the end, that's kind of showing you that he has grown and learned as a person. But I just mean in terms of where the character is at the start of the movie is just not where that kind of character usually is at the beginning of that kind of a story, and I like that.
Absolutely, and I mean, I think the best example of that, right, and I'm sighing as I even say it, is the Star Wars prequels, right? Like, did we really need to go back and see Anakin as a kid? Did we really need to go back and see him building C-3PO?
Oh, God.
You know, and I think that franchise kind of came off the rails there. And I mean, I think Hayden Christensen is, if not a terrible actor, gave a terrible performance once they had him grow up a little bit. But, you know, the TV show, the Clone Wars TV show is excellent. It's phenomenal. I love it. And that one kind of starts with, you know, an older Anakin. And so you can kind of hit the ground running and get into the real kind of issues at play. And so I think you're exactly right. I mean, I'm thrilled we didn't get a 20-something-year-old Tony Stark. But I do remember that's one of the things that, you know, I had said about casting Robert Downey Jr. was that he was already in his 40s when Iron Man came out. I think he was 43 when in 2008. So I mean, he was, you know, early 40s when they were filming this, and I just remember thinking, like, how are you going to build an action franchise out of a 40-year-old actor, right? Like,
unless it's Roger Moore.
yeah. How is this going to work? Is this going to kind of burn? Like, is that, even if they like, they're successful and they have this big hit movie, like, how many films are they really going to get out of this guy before they have to move it? And so I was kind of curious about why they went with somebody older like that. You know, he's in his 50s now, but kind of the joy of Iron Man, right? And, you know, shame on me for not realizing, is you can put anybody in that suit, right? Like, you don't have to be a 20-year-old kid to be Iron Man. I mean, obviously, like, the way your mind works, the way your reflexes work, play with the suit, but you can have an older guy get in that suit especially somebody who's built it and designed it and is that kind of brilliant. And so having him be, you know, kind of mid-career, it almost makes his transition seem like his midlife crisis, right? And I suppose for normal people, when they have a midlife crisis, they want to go buy a Ferrari, right? Well, right. If you're Tony Stark and you can have any car in the world you want, when you have a midlife crisis, it's going to go the other way, and you're going to look for something a little bit more tangible, right? You're going to look for something a little bit more, you know, towards building a legacy. And so it does make sense. And so, like, starting him there, all of that worked. And it's also Stane, right? The thing I like about Stane is that he needs Stark, right? Mm-hmm. And he's aware of this. Like, Stark needs him and maybe is less aware of it because he doesn't want to be bothered with all the kind of business stuff. You know, they roll him out when he needs to dazzle somebody or when they've got a new weapon to show off. But really, it's Stane who does the day-to-day kind of grunt work to build and grow the company. But he needs Stark's weapons to do it. And so it is telling when he finally gets the Iron Man armor, you can kind of see Stane realize that, like, yeah, this is it, right? This is the golden ticket, and I can take this technology and cash out, right? Make all the money I've ever wanted to make now and go do whatever it is I want to do with untold billions of dollars, and we can kill Stark and get rid of him because he's never going to make anything better than this. Or if it is, it's not going to be worth it, right? And you can even people who are billionaires at some point, there's only so many billions you can have. And you know, so you see Stane kind of like say like this, all right, this is it. This is the time where I can cash out. He's built the ultimate weapon. I can sell this until I die and not worry about it.
Speaking of, well, and we end up with Pepper getting promoted up into Stane's role because, like you said, Tony doesn't want to deal with all the business aspects of it. He's the idea guy. And I want to talk a little bit about this supporting cast with Pepper. I mean, you know, Iron Man has had about as many girlfriends as there have been Bond girls, but she was the original. In fact, honestly, if you compare Tony Stark girlfriends through the comics history to James Bond movies, Pepper was Moneypenny.
Yeah.
She wasn't like the Bond girl of the year. She was Moneypenny. She was the secretary. She was the one that liked Bond, you know, liked Tony from a distance, but he was always out with the glamorous others. And so it's been very interesting how basically Tony has ended up with Moneypenny. You know, we haven't gotten the other Stark girls, particularly Rumiko, who was a very big one for a while, and Bethany Cabe. I just talked to David Michelinie on this show, you know, a couple of episodes ago about Bethany and the other Iron Man girls. So, and then of course you got. It's interesting how they kind of pick and chose the supporting cast from different eras. So you get Rhodey from the Michelinie and later era, late 70s, early 80s. But you also get Pepper and you get Happy Hogan from the early, you know, period. Because by the time I started reading Iron Man in 1977 with number 96, Happy Hogan and Pepper Potts were already out of the book and never really came back until after the first movie came out.
Yeah, it was, you know, and that I think is something that the Marvel Cinematic Universe has done very well where the X-Men franchise has not done well, right? It feels, even though, you know, both franchises have kind of, you know, pick and chose from different eras who to bring in, who to concentrate on. Yeah. In the Marvel Cinematic Universe and starting with Iron Man, even though they're pulling characters from different eras, it feels like they were chosen for a specific reason, right? Like, and that reason was kind of how they rotate around Stark, right? What does each character tell us about Tony that the other ones don't tell us about Tony? Whereas in, I think, the X-Men franchises, it's more just kind of a grab bag mess, right? It's like, oh, we haven't used Gambit yet. Let's throw him into a few scenes because why not? Because I know Friday Night Lights is a hit, so we've got that guy under contract. So I don't think, you know, X-Men just feels more just like, you know, a random grab bag of like reach your hand in, pull out a tile when you're playing Scrabble or whatever. Where in the cinematic unit, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, it feels much more like these characters were chosen for a reason, right? And all of them have a very specific reason why they're in the film. I mean, Happy doesn't do so much in the first movie, but he's there, right? He's that kind of background presence. And Pepper is there to show us, you know, the personal side of Tony. And Rhodey's there to show us the kind of it's wrong to say like he's his conscience, but he is. Like, I mean, I think Rhodey's a fascinating character in this movie because he is the guy who, I mean, he's the liaison, right, between Stark and the military. And so his interest is first and foremost with the military. And then I think you see over the course of the film, like the friendship they've had comes out more and more. But it's there to show the personal side too, but it's also, I think, to show the growth of Tony as a character, right? If you've got a friend who's been one way all his life and then suddenly he changes course, especially when that affects your job. You know, there's that scene where Tony tries to get Rhodey to come to work for him, right? Leave the military, come work for me. And Rhodey has too much of a sense of duty to the military to do that. But he is that, you know, I think, you know, Rhodey is important in showing that change in Tony much more, I think, than Pepper, right? Because I think the way they've created Pepper is, I mean, she's the loyalist, right? She's always going to look out for Tony first, mm-hmm. where Stain always looks out for the business first, and Rhodey is kind of the in-between. Like, he cares about his friend, but he's also on him all the time, right? There's a scene in the plane where, well, first, Stark is late getting to the plane, right, at the start of the movie. And he shows up and Rhodey's like, you're 3 hours late. And Stark kind of brushes right past him and goes, yeah, well, now we're waiting on you. Get in the plane, right? And then Rhodey is mad on the plane ride. And then you have that scene where all of the stewardesses start dancing around the cabin on the stripper pole and stuff. And Rhodey is like not even looking at them, right? Like, he's focused on Tony and trying to like get his point across. So, yeah, they do, you know, the three of them, you know, I think, Happy is just kind of there to be there in this film, but the other three of them really bring out those different aspects of Tony. And so they were chosen well and they mesh together well, right? And I think that's the thing about being a longtime comics reader is everything kind of blends together after a while, right? And your mind kind of, you know, sorts in all these people as his supporting cast, even if maybe they haven't had the biggest kind of interpersonal relationships between them over the years. It feels like the right supporting cast for Stark.
Yeah, for a movie, no other Bond girl, no other Tony girl would have worked because she has a connection to him pre-existing, right? I mean, the only other way you could have probably done it is have Beth be the female character and have her be Tony's bodyguard, you know, because she was a bodyguard in the comics, because then, you know, you'd have the chemistry would have been, the relationship would have been, she's Tony's bodyguard and he gets wounded and captured despite, you know, her being the bodyguard. And then by the end of the movie, he's sort of become his own bodyguard and she's become kind of redundant. And so you could have done some maybe interesting story things there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the decision to, right, they clearly made a decision at some point when they were putting not only Iron Man together, the character, the movie, the franchise, all three layers of that, that Tony and Pepper were going to be in a relationship, right? Mm-hmm. That they cut his womanizing midstream too, and that was also going to be a shift. And they weren't going to do the womanizing aspect. They weren't going to push at the alcoholism, right? That this was going to be a much more, lovable scamp, Tony Stark, that's what they were going for. And I do think, like, I mean, Pepper is slightly problematic to me in that she's such a loyalist in this movie that, and that he doesn't see it, right? Because like he sends her into Stark Industries to download all of the secret stuff that Stane's been working on. So he puts her in harm's way, kind of aware of it, but also like, I mean, you would think somebody that smart could take 10 minutes and develop a way to hack into the system, right? And pull it out without anybody knowing it. You know, go to a coffee shop and like sit down and hack into Stark Industries mainframe and pull all that stuff out. That maybe would be a little bit safer than sending Pepper in to, you know, to pull it right from his office with Stane watching her. But it is Pepper's role in the film. I think that's one of the things that I dislike about Pepper in this movie is she doesn't really have. I don't feel like she has a real arc. I mean, I feel like at the start of the movie and at the end of the movie, she's just kind of blindly loyal to Tony, right? Doesn't want him to hurt himself. And that's her primary concern, right? Because he even says to her, like, all those, like, when she threatens to walk out, and he's like, all of those years that I was building weapons and you were okay with it, and now I want to make a difference and you're going to leave, right? And that's where she tells him that her primary interest isn't, like, the state of the world. It's the state of Tony Stark. And when he was womanizing and building weapons and getting drunk and doing all his partying stuff, she was okay with that, right? Because he was always going to come home at the end of the night. But now when he's putting himself into danger in the costume, in the Iron Man suit, that's kind of like a breaking point for her, right? That's the hurdle that she needs to get over. But I don't really feel like she has much of an arc in the film. She's certainly competent. I mean, but I enjoy the scenes between her and Phil Coulson.
Yeah.
100 times more than I enjoy the scenes between her and Tony Stark.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, she's more the catalyst in a way who doesn't change than she is like a character that changes. It's all about Tony changing. Nobody else in the movie really changes. But we'll talk about Coulson and S.H.I.E.L.D. for a minute. Did you figure out who that was supposed to be pretty quickly? And what did you think about them sort of sneaking S.H.I.E.L.D. into this movie from the very beginning?
Well, I mean, it's amazing to me, right, that Clark Gregg has played Phil Coulson more than anybody else in that movie has played any of those characters, right? I mean, how many times has Robert Downey Jr. shown up to play Iron Man at this time? Like, what, 6-7 times or whatever? Yeah. But, like, I mean, Phil Coulson has got 3 years of a TV show out of this role. I mean, I did – like, that to me was the effective kind of swerve that they put in the film, right, that he was – you know, because he's a very kind of middle management type. He's very kind of quiet. He's very kind of unassuming, but solid, right? And so I like how they kind of laid him into the film, right? That he's there. He's always there. You know, he's always kind of lurking like in the shadows in a different way than Happy is, right? I mean, Happy's on the inside. Coulson's on the outside, but he always seems to be there in the background, right? He's at all or most of the important things, and he slowly asserts himself over the course of the film.
Yeah.
And I had, you know, when in my original review of the movie, I had wondered if his role in this film was supposed to be the guy who takes the bullet, right? Mm. That there's nobody in this film who dies for Tony after he gets out of the Middle East, right? Like, I wondered, like, was Coulson, like, when I saw him, because, you know, Coulson's not a character, you know, from the comics, right? It wasn't like, you know, Nick Fury was standing there, you know, asking for a meeting. It wasn't even like it was Jasper Sitwell.
Exactly.
Or, you know, Henry Peter Gyrich standing there for a meeting. It's just this middle management type. So I was like, well, this guy's going to die, right? This guy is going to take a bullet for Pepper at some point. Especially when you get to the end and they're running around and the Ironmonger makes his, you know, debut. It's like, oh yeah, Coulson he's going to die. I wondered if, like, was he set up to be the guy who's going to die? And then they decided at some point we need to cut that because this guy is really good in this role. Or if he was always set up to be kind of the guy who was going to do the work kind of linking these movies together.
Yeah, it's a good question because especially in light of what happens to him in Avengers.
Right.
Where, right. I mean, you know, Joss Whedon is famous for saying, you know, you got to kill somebody the audience likes at some point in the story. And so it was inevitable that somebody was going to get killed in Avengers. And I wonder, yeah, you bring up a good point, which is how did he make it that far that he was available to be killed? I mean, and why did Joss get to be the one to kill him when he'd been around three movies already? So several.
Yeah, like I wonder. I mean, and I think that comes back to, right, having Kevin Feige in the kind of overlord seat there. Which if his office chair isn't like Thanos' throne, I'll be completely disappointed. Because he is the overlord of all of this. I mean, he is the guy pulling all the strings, and you know, certainly a discussion for another day. But the idea that DC really hasn't had their version of him, I think, is why their films have had such a problem kind of getting off the ground and getting going. But you know, so. Whether Phil Coulson was intended to be, you know, the connector between all of these movies, or that was something that came up kind of in process, it was one of the best decisions. I mean, I think his role in Iron Man is appearing as like this middle management guy who has to go out and do the work his boss doesn't want to do. He's also very good at his job, right? And that he was able to give that kind of what at first seemed maybe like, you know, a little bit of meekness or being timid or being that kind of person that gets stepped on, right? He has a quiet confidence in his abilities, which come out over the course of the movie. When Pepper needs to be saved, right, it's Coulson who's sitting there ready to save her. And I think it's just a wonderful character. And I mean, I think really of all the things that kind of emerged from Iron Man, I would not have assumed that, you know, SHIELD middle management officer was going to be the thing that ended up being one of the things I was most excited about. But I mean, I was, you know, even at, like when I left that movie, I was like, that, you know, that guy kind of stole the show in his own ways. Like he stole every scene he was in and did it very kind of quietly, did it kind of under the radar. And so it was, you know, and that was huge, right? I mean, remember how excited we all were sitting through those credits just to see Nick Fury show up at the end, right? And just to talk about the Avenger initiative and just to say you're not the only superhero. I mean, I remember that just being like, oh my God, like I can't, like they're really going to do this, right? We're really going to get another movie where these characters show up. It's, you know, we're done with this idea that all superheroes take place in their own universe. I mean, I remember the George Clooney Batman movie, whatever one that was, Batman and Robin, I think. Robin. Like how excited I was in the thing. That was a terrible movie, but like how excited I was in the theater, like when he mentioned Metropolis, right? I was like, yeah, oh my God, yes, Metropolis. Like that means Superman, right? Like this is a universe. This isn't just a guy standalone superhero, which is, you know, one of the problems that I think the DC universe has is that Chris Nolan in his Batman trilogy was very clear in saying, this is the only superhero. This is the only one. This is the only guy. Right. Yeah. There is nobody else out there or this doesn't work. Right. And so that closed door approach, you know, is kind of Nolan was kind of the last hurrah for that in this era. And now it's all, you know, it's all shared universes. But that first time, you know, and there's the scene in Iron Man where you can see Cap's shield sitting on the workbench. Right. It's like I totally missed it the first time. The second time I went in and saw it, I was like looking for it. I was like, oh yeah, there it is, you know? And so that kind of shared universe and Coulson was really important, I think, in getting that going. As excited and giddy as we were just to see Nick Fury standing there, you know, Coulson really became the link between the films much more than any other character did.
Younger fans coming up now will never understand how huge that kind of thing has been, right? I mean, that it took us that long to get that they'll never understand that there was a moment seeing a piece of metal sitting on a table in a movie. Oh my gosh, you know, I mean, they'll never understand that, but it's absolutely true. And the thing to me is, how did it take them this long to figure out that what was so successful in comics for at that point, you know, 50 years or whatever, or 60, 70 years, was the way to go? Why would they not think that was the way to go? It took them freaking forever to figure that out. It's amazing. Yeah.
It is, and DC still hasn't figured it out, right? I mean, DC has an incredibly successful TV franchise, and they're like, nah, the movies are going to be different, right? And again, it's I don't know if it's ego, I mean, I guess it has to be ego, right? At some point, you have to decide that I know how to do this character better than the people who've been doing the character for 50, 60, 70 years, right? That, yeah. And even like in DC's case, like I know how to do this character better than the people who've made a hit TV show, right? I mean, yeah. Several hit TV shows. And I do think like DC missed a huge opportunity, right? To say they could have DC loves its multiverses, right? Like once they decided that the TV shows were going to be different from the movies, they should have done their whole, you know, Earth 1, Earth 2 split or whatever and made a determination, right? That, okay, if Barry Allen is going to be the TV Flash, we need to have, you know, Jay Garrick or Wally West be the cinematic Flash, and we need to keep them separate because at some point then we will make lots of money doing a movie where the TV people fight the movie people, right?
Yeah.
But they just seem like they can't get out of their way. And it is – I mean, you said it perfectly, right? People – kids today will never be – you know, never realize how excited and giddy we were to see like – you know, a shield on a table, right? That it was like, or to see a character show up who you knew was going to be in another movie or hinting at another movie. I mean, it was like, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It was so, I mean, the thing I always said about Spider-Man, right? When I watched the first Spider-Man movie, I remember going back, I was in grad school at the time. I went back to class and my professor was kind of like, oh, you go see movies like that? Like, you know, looking down her nose at it. And I said, yeah. And it was kind of the perfect movie because it made me remember why the 5-year-old me was so into superheroes without insulting the adult version of me, right? Yeah. And that's what the Marvel Cinematic Universe has done. I think that's why they continue to be successful. They've perfectly managed to meet those two two masters, right? Like to make people happy, to remember what it was like to just be a kid and be kind of wide-eyed about superheroes, right? But also without insulting the adult version of you, right? And I mean, not to keep bashing on the Star Wars prequels, but I always thought that was why the Star Wars prequels didn't work, right? It's like because between Return of the Jedi and The Phantom Menace, we all got older and smarter and better, and George Lucas was already fully developed when he made Jedi, right? And so he didn't kind of advance with the rest of us. And so those prequel movies suffer a bit from kind of stilted growth. And it was also, I mean, we don't have to get into it. There's a million reasons why, but I mean, I think that was one of the reasons where when Iron Man came along, like, okay, it wasn't exactly the Iron Man I remember from the comics, but it was reminiscent of that while not insulting the adult version. I mean, I think we all realize at this point that you're never going to get a one-to-one translation of comics to screen. Right. And the choices that they made in Iron Man seemed to be choices that were made for the betterment of the movie and the betterment of the character. They made sense in the character for the character in this film in ways that, like in other films, like it didn't. Like I still like the organic web shooters in Spider-Man, right? Like that to me takes something away from Peter. And it's not that, you know, web shooters are cooler than, you know, fluid coming out of your wrist. It's that spoke to Peter being an inventor, right? And I think that's why in Civil War, when Tony goes to Peter's apartment, right, he sees that Peter has been building the web shooter. And because it reinserts that important part of the character. And so I think with Downey Jr.'s approach to playing Iron Man, it was reminiscent enough of the Tony Stark we knew while also merging in the best of Robert Downey Jr. to, you know, create, you know, the cinematic Tony Stark, which is its own being from, you know, apart from the comics.
Yeah, that's right. The last thing that I want to get to here at the end is to kind of wrap it up is kind of looking back at this movie and its place as we go forward. And I want to point out, you know, you're talking about Tony Stark's character. I failed to mention, and I wanted to mention this before we finish, that I think that the one big loser in how they changed Tony Stark to make him a more appealing character in a movie, the big loser in that was Hawkeye. Because I've always said, you know, Tony Stark was kind of a boring character. He was supposed to be. He's Howard Hughes. You know, he's kind of like this businessman. And Hawkeye was the irreverent, jokey, you know, superhero of the Avengers. And so they basically took a lot of Hawkeye's character and personality and gave it to Tony Stark, or Downey kind of appropriated it. That left us with a Jeremy Renner Hawkeye who's not horrible, but he's just not terribly. I mean, I think that they've done more stuff with him in the last couple of movies. They've kind of focused on him being a caring companion to Black Widow and having a wife and kids, and they've made a new Hawkeye. They've sort of manufactured a new Hawkeye that is appealing in that way, but he's nothing like the Clint Barton from the comics. So somebody had to suffer.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think he's always been the kind of weakest character in this whole universe. It didn't feel like they knew who he was, right? It always felt like he was not like a fully realized character, that his role kind of got co-opted a bit here and there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even like some of the, the stuff with like Captain America, right? I mean, that's gone to like the Winter Soldier. Like that's Cap's buddy is Bucky, not Hawkeye. And so I feel like it's kind of been like a bit of a lost character, here and there. I mean, as cool as it was to see him show up in Thor, it never felt like an Avengers, right? I mean, he was the guy who got his mind taken over. It was like he didn't really have too many moments. He didn't feel like – he felt like a function more than a character. And I think it was when they went to his house, right? And it's, he's got a wife and kids. Like the character finally started to kind of round into shape, right? Where it was like, now I understand who this guy is. Before, he's just a guy in a mask, right? He's performing a function. They need somebody to do X, and we'll give it to Hawkeye to do it. But now, in the last couple movies, he finally feels like he's like a real guy. And I think in Civil War, that was the first time I felt that kind of that comics classic version of Clint Barton kind of showing through, right? Like that was the guy, you know, when they went to his house and it turns out he had a family, that was like, this is like the barbecue Hawkeye, right? This is the guy who wants, you know, the West Coast Hawkeye, who wants everybody to like come hang out for a barbecue. And then when you get to Civil War, and that's when he did start to get under Stark's skin, right? That's where he was kind of antagonistic to Tony. And that, you know, I was like, now they're doing something with him, right? And it's a shame, I suppose, being a huge Hawkeye fan, that, you know, he has been, you know, kind of bounced – his characterization has seemed a little unsettled or unfocused, and we're never going to get a Hawkeye movie, right? Mm-hmm. And I was kind of intrigued when, you know, Jeremy Renner had said, like last year, I think it was, somebody had brought up the idea of doing a Hawkeye TV show, and he was like, yeah, I'm all for it. And it's like, I think that's where you could do a Hawkeye story, maybe, is, you know, if Netflix just wants to keep throwing money at you, like instead of eventually doing, you know, I don't know, Great Lakes Avengers. I mean, maybe we'll get like a Hawkeye TV show instead of, or not. But I mean, it's, you know, it is. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, that character does feel unsettled and unfocused. And, you know, Downey Jr. appropriated some of that in his portrayal of Stark.
And he's the least like the comics character probably of any Marvel movie character, I would say.
Yeah.
Maybe he's like the Ultimates Hawkeye, I can't even remember, but he's nothing like Clint Barton. I mean, he's interesting, but yeah. Well, let's bring it to a close. What's your final word on Iron Man from 2008?
You know, I thought about this, and I don't want to overstate it. I don't want to give into hyperbole, but I do think it is the most important superhero film of this generation, right? For a couple reasons. And yes, we had the X-Men franchise was going, the Spider-Man franchise, the Batman franchise had been going successfully until then. But this was the first time that I really felt like they took a secondary character, at least in the public's eye, mm-hmm. and made made people care about it, right? That they, that this was like the film. I mean, in 2008, it was like, if you went to any movie that year, you had to go see Iron Man. And so one, they turned Iron Man and thus the Avengers into like a cultural phenomenon, right? So the success of the movie was massive, but it also, they set the blueprint for the entire cinematic universe. I mean, like, what do we say at the beginning? There's 22 films that have either been released or that are, you know, on the slate to be released. 22 movies, and it really goes back to Iron Man setting the tone, creating the blueprint for the entire Marvel universe, right? That these were going to be movies that weren't afraid to be bright, that weren't afraid to have humor, that weren't afraid to have flawed characters. That, you know, that weren't going to focus on the villains a whole lot. I mean, in most of these movies, the villains, like you said, the villains are kind of the weak point. They're kind of, they're the function that gets the plot moving forward, but it's going to be focused on the heroes, right? They're going to, and that the characters themselves, I think for the most part are, you know, it's like a two-step process. It's part one, you take the kind of classic iteration of the character and then you cast it with somebody, and then you let that person's personality, what they do best, infuse into the character, right? Like, I do wonder, like, when we see Doctor Strange, are we going to get kind of the – is there going to be any scenes in there where it's like the Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock-style dialogue, right? That Stephen Moffat, rapid-fire, quick, or is it going to be – you know, is any of that going to be in the film, or is it going to be clearly – the kind of classic version of Stephen Strange, right? So I think Iron Man is – you can't understate the importance of Iron Man in creating the blueprint for the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe, right, in ways that nothing else before it had been able to do, right? And that comes from, one, being a great movie, two, being incredibly well acted and directed, but three, also giving us that sense that this was a doorway – right, that this wasn't a standalone movie. I mean, we knew they had other movies planned, right? And they were able to, in this movie, make a movie that stood on its own, but also if you knew what to look for, you could see that they were setting up things that were going to pay off down the line. And so I think it's in its own way, it's the, you know, as much as, you know, Spider-Man was incredibly important and X-Men 2 was incredibly important, I think this is – Iron Man was the most important movie of this run because it – created the blueprint that allowed everything that came after it to have the confidence to be what it was going to be.
Yeah, and I guess I'll just add, I kind of look at Iron Man 1 the way I look at the Lord of the Rings movies, which is, you know, it's a property I dearly, dearly loved before they made the movie, many years before they made the movie. They made the movie. Was it exactly the way I wanted it? Was it exactly the way I would have done it? No. But was it quality? Absolutely. Was it successful? Absolutely. Did it bring millions more people into the fold? Absolutely. And so I can live with them not making it just for me if they make it for millions of other people too. So I guess I can put up with that. So
yeah, and I suppose the tragedy, right, is that the Iron Man sequels, at least I feel like the Iron Man sequels are, you know, at the bottom end of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, right? Like, I don't feel that either one of those, and we'll talk about them when we get to them, were nearly as well made as not only Iron Man, but the kind of the other films that followed in the cinematic universe. And then, you know, we can talk about why that is when we get to them. But as a film, like, it was incredibly important. It was, I mean, I can remember, you know, coming out of that theater and just being like we are really at the beginning of something special here. It'll always be an incredibly important film for that.
It has kind of done the opposite of the Captain America trilogy, which is they've gotten better and these have gotten worse. But, oh, well, they're all still, yeah. These, well, yeah, Iron Man 3 is a whole other thing. But other than that, we'll get to it. So, all right. Well, we're going to wrap up for now. And I appreciate you coming on, Mark. This has been awesome. Great, great discussion of this movie. We may have to do the 2 and 3 as one episode. I don't know if I'll spend a whole hour talking about 3, but or almost honestly, a good bit of 2. But well, yeah,
we could probably, because I know we have a different view of their treatment of the Mandarin. So we could probably spend an hour talking just about that.
All right. Well, that'll be cool. Something for the audience to look forward to. All right. Well, we're going to get on out of here. I appreciate it. And I guess at this point, all that remains to say, as always, is Avengers Assemble.
Avengers Assemble. Thanks.
All right. Our world's about to break. Tormenting and obsessed. Lost from when we wake. No way to go back. I'm standing on my own. But now I'm not alone. Avengers Assemble.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.